The very first reading is actually, I think it does touch on his birth at the end, but in a way, it's about his womb. Yeah, that's the womb that he comes from, which you'll see isn't a womb; it's a lake. So we'll hear about that, and then I'll say something about it.
Canto 14. The Qualities of the Lake of Dharnakosha. The Lake of Parturition. Then the Buddha Amitabha, from his palace of immaculate precious stones, sent forth an emanation with gifts, physical, verbal, and mental, established as the Emperor Sangbochog, best of the good, whose corporeal form was endowed with the 32 favourable signs. Dominating the four continents, he set turning the wheel of the Dharma, and with his supernatural glance, he considered the six directions. In order to raise up from the six classes of beings, six sages and six gurus as regenerative messengers, and to stimulate among men faith in the fruit of one's deeds, his first glance fell upon Indrabhuti, who had lost his son. Because Sangbochog had resolved to vanquish the evil genies in the territories of savage Tibet, and since a miraculous birth was needed to inspire conviction, his second glance fell upon the turquoise, dazzling, immaculate lake. His third glance, within the kingdom of Tibet, land of those repulsive malefactors, the Rakshakas, fell upon the great king, Trisung Detsen, who would cause the lamp of the Dharma to shine in the darkness. Here is a clear analysis in precise terms. In the lake region of Dharnakosha in Uddiyana, the dazzling, immaculate lake covers fully 2,000 leagues in length and breadth. The perimeter of the dazzling, immaculate lake is 100,000 leagues in extent. It is circular and azure in hue. The dazzling immaculate lake has eight characteristics, which specifically may be detailed in this way. The water is pure and clear, cool and sweet, perfumed and thirst-quenching, good and agreeable in taste. Being pure, it accepts no defilement. Being clear, no mud clouds it. Being cool, it is glacial. Being sweet, there is no hardship in drinking it. Being perfumed, it has a pleasant smell. Being agreeable in taste, it is an exquisite drink. Being thirst-quenching, It relieves the body's heat. Being good, it is beneficial for the body and beneficial for sick folk possessed by vijna demons. This water is the domain of prodigies difficult to grasp. When drunk by those whose karma is good, it obliterates the faults committed by beings. Men who see it, drink it, and bathe in it, even the disputatious, when they drink this water, become tranquil. The bellicose also, by drinking this water, become peaceful. The frenzied also, by drinking this water, become harmless. The enraged also, by drinking this water, become calm. Looking at the numerous beings of the six classes, with the piercing eye of contemplation, and spying out the wicked wherever they abide, that supreme splendour on earth, the holy guide, was born out of the kosher lake toward the southwest of the land of Uddiyana, in the region of the great lake. Apparition of unending happiness, excellent and beautiful on the northwest side, on the northeastern side of the town of Marble, are found the lotus stalk and the forest of Udumbara. By day in the sunlight, the flowers sink to the bottom. By night, they rise to float, luminous, on the surface of this ocean of benediction. And the holy guide was born from this lake of kosher. Of the history, unabridged, of the lives of the Guru of Uddiyana, Padmasambhava, this is the 14th canto. The looks, the qualities of the dazzling immaculate lake, and the lake parturation, sealed oaths.
So a little bit of background. The kings generally symbolise this sort of the source of power and control, in other words, the ego, the self. So we can perhaps think of it in that way. We can think of the king as being representation of that part of our psyche, if we want to look at this story from a kind of more personal psychological angle. But I'm just going to talk about the king in a symbolic sense. His son had died, and He was distraught and wanted another son. So as kings would do in those cultures, they made offerings. And he offered everything in his kingdom. The treasury was completely emptied with the offerings that he gave to people. But still, he had no son. So he had to start to look in different directions. He got all sorts of advice about what to do, you know, go to war, open a jeweled mine, all sorts of suggestions. In the end, what he did is he sailed away with this kind of rather strange sailor who'd come into the town. And they went off to a foreign land, to a distant land. And as soon as they got to this distant land, the king was blind. When they got to this distant land, one of the king's eyes opened. So he was no longer blind. And there were lots of jewels there. So they collected up all of these jewels and brought them back to the kingdom. That's cutting a fairly long story quite short. But obviously he's gone to a distant land. He's gone to somewhere different. He's gone into a different space. And through going into that different space, he's been enabled to see somewhat clearer. So he's lost the total ignorance that he was in previously, in his blindness. And he's got partial sight, as it were, partial wisdom. And that wisdom also brings with it riches. So whether these riches are material or spiritual doesn't really matter. But he's got all of these riches now that he can continue with the work that he was doing previously. But he still hasn't solved his problem. He still doesn't have a son. It's then said, somebody comes to him and tells him that there's a child. There's a child on a lotus in this lake. And the king should go and maybe claim this child. So this is what this reading has been concerned with. It's been concerned with the place of the birth of Padmasambhava. So let's just have a little look at this place. Padma was born from the dazzling immaculate lake, Dhanakosha. So what could this refer to? What's being talked about here? It seems as though what's being referred to is a higher state of consciousness. It's something which is out of this world. It's not an ordinary lake by any means, as we'll see from its description later. So let's assume that this is a... one of the things I should say about symbols and so on, there are many different interpretations of them. You know, nothing is sort of definitive. But one can sort of, as it were, use one's creative imagination to investigate them. It does, however, seem very clear that the Dhanakosha lake is referring to higher states of consciousness. It's referring to what we normally refer to as dhyana. So it's states in which the mind has been purified. Let's just look at some of the qualities of it. First of all, it's very big. It's 100,000 leagues in circumference. That's very big. So this Dhanakosha lake, this purified mind, is a big mind. It's not just a teeny little egoistic mind that is just concerned with, you know, things of the day. It's expansive. It's vast. So it's a vast, dazzling, immaculate lake. And it has these eight characteristics. The water, in other words, the state of consciousness, is pure and clear, cool and sweet. So we must imagine our minds in this state. Vast, cool, sweet, pure. Not with the normal kind of everyday activities going on. It's perfumed. So it's got a sort of a certain delicacy to it as well. It's not sort of... it's not gross. It's got kind of a refined perfume to it. And it's thirst-quenching. In other words, it satisfies one's desire. Just in that little phrase there, this lake is thirst-quenching. Well, as you know, I mean, it's in a way thirst, craving, is seen as the kind of the thing that gives us all our problems. It's that which gives rise to suffering, according to Buddhism. So this lake actually quenches that thirst. Our normal thirsts, our normal desires, don't get quenched for very long. Maybe they do briefly, but they don't. It doesn't sort of last. But the water from this particular lake, this lake of a higher state of consciousness, does actually quench your thirst. It is deeply satisfying. I mean, this is something really worth thinking about, isn't it, when one's meditating and when you're going on retreat, that what you may have left behind, you know, all your, you know, box sets, friends, you know, all the sort of pleasant activities of life and so on, but what is really on offer, what you could really discover, and this is within everybody's experience, is a thirst-quenching lake of purity. that can be found within one's own mind. It's good. That's another thing that you realise when you kind of enter into this lake. You say, this is good. You know, this has got value. It's got genuine, lasting value. It's not something that's just pleasant. It's actually got a lasting value. And it's agreeable. There's absolutely nothing about it which is disagreeable. And again, thinking about one's normal life, you know, there's some very agreeable things happen in life, but there's usually a little sort of disagreeable edge to it. You know, something isn't quite right, or it's not going to last for long enough, or one loses it, or something like that happens. Well, with the lake, with the waters of this lake of higher consciousness, it is thoroughly agreeable. There's nothing disagreeable about it. Being pure, it accepts no defilements. So that means that if you're experiencing this level of consciousness and a defilement arises, which they do, you know, a kind of bit of resentment, bit of hatred, bit of envy, bit of grasping, something like that, it won't stick, it won't stay there. The waters, as it were, throw it out immediately. It's immediately rejected. So the purity is maintained. The defilement cannot exist within that lake. Being clear, it's a state of mind, it's a consciousness that's completely clear. There's no mud clouds it. One doesn't get cloudy. Again, this is different from our everyday state of consciousness most of the time. Every now and again we get moments of clarity, but quite often it's, you know, it is a bit muddy, isn't it? It's sort of we haven't got things quite clear. There's a bit of confusion around. But in this particular state, we're absolutely clear. There's nothing confusing about it. Being cool, it's glacial. I must say, I don't know what that means. I haven't sort of really got much of an idea about that, except perhaps that it occurs when something more solid has dissolved. You know, when the waters of the sometimes the mind does feel a bit rigid, doesn't it? A bit sort of solid, like a glacier, a bit cold, emotionally unengaged, something like that. Or when that kind of melts, then the water itself is cool. It's not sort of gone over the top, but it's flowing. It's free. Being sweet, there is no hardship in drinking it. You know, you could sit there and drink it forever. That's what it feels like. You know, you could just sit there forever. You think, this is it. You know, we're here forever now. That's fine. I don't mind. If I die now, that's fine. I don't mind, because there's the sweetness to it. Being perfumed, it has a pleasant smell. Again, this suggesting a kind of delicacy. It's not a kind of a harsh experience. It's sort of got, I don't know, you know, if you're walking out someday and you just catch a perfume of some flowers or trees, lime trees are a bit like this, aren't you? You know, you catch the perfume of a lime tree and it's just, it's very delicate. You can't exactly tell where it's coming from, but it's sort of delicately present. Being agreeable in taste, being agreeable in taste, it's an exquisite drink. So again, it's something that you can satisfy your thirst with, and it's exquisite. It's not just a crude satisfaction of thirst, but it's an exquisite satisfaction. And being thirst quenching, it relieves the body's heat. In other words, it relieves all of the kind of intense passions of a human existence. And being good, it's beneficial. You feel that this is worthwhile. It's of value. And it's said to cure sickness. And it's the domain of prodigies. I looked this up in the dictionary, actually. and a prodigy is a marvellous happening. So it's a place in which all sorts of marvellous things occur. So this Lake Dharnakosha is referring to the what we would call within the tradition generally the samatha experience, the experience of dhyana, the experience of a purified, tranquil mind. And it's from this state that Padmasambhava arises. We're also told that the disputatious, when they drink this water, become tranquil. The bellicose also, by drinking this water, become peaceful. The frenzied also, by drinking this water, become harmless. And the enraged also, by drinking this water, become calm. So this is outlining the qualities of that level of consciousness. So we're not talking about something here which is, you know, way beyond our experience. This is something that we can sort of experience within our own meditation. Now, what's more was that on a lotus from this lake, I think one of the things about this sort of state of consciousness, well, it says, doesn't it, that prodigies occur. One of the things about this state of mind is that stuff comes up. All sorts of unexpected and strange things sort of emerge from this lake of Dharnakosha. And this is where Padmasambhava has come from. There's a lotus. Odumbra lotuses are rather strange. They're utterly enormous. I've heard different descriptions of them, but sometimes they're sort of, you know, hundreds of miles across. So they're big. In this case, they seem to be somewhat smaller. They seem to be a bit more human-sized. But the important thing is that in the daytime, they're down below the surface. In other words, in normal consciousness, these lotuses sink down into the mind. We don't experience them. They're under the surface. But at night, when normal consciousness, as it were, has been eclipsed, then they start to rise up to the surface. So it's as though Padmasambhava is coming up from deep in the surface of our own, in the depths of our own mind. But that's what's being said here, that Padmasambhava arises from out of that that higher state of consciousness, as described in the as the Lake of Dharnakosha. So this is what he is, and this is where he comes from. And so the story so far is that from the depths of a purified mind, from the depths of the Dharnakosha lake, Padmasambhava, the enlightened magician, has risen to the surface in the form of a child. So now we'll have the next reading.
Canto 17. The meeting with King Indrabhuti and the signs of cause and effect. Then the prow of the ship being turned around, the king with his following returned to his country. And holding a tall lotus, the orthodox minister, Trigundahara, took a boat and went to meet him. Now in the southwest of the Diamond Throne of India, in the northwest of the western country of Udayana, in a lotus garden at the northwest of Dharnakosha, on an island of the great lake Brilliant Immaculate, in the midst of a countless arrival of flocks of water birds, scarlet ducks, grey cranes and others, a tent was pitched, a luminous circle in five rainbow colours. The king then said to Trigunadhara, "Tell those down there to come here. No longer does the king have the same blindness. Once the wish-fulfilling jewel was obtained, my left eye, after a prayer, was opened." "There is," said the minister, "in the middle of a lotus garden, a miraculous child seated. May the king consider taking the blessed child away at daybreak, and let him deign to see him himself." And King Indrabhuti said, "We must go near. Last night I had a dream that a radiant golden vajra with 9 points appeared from the sky and came into my hand, and I dreamed that the sun was rising in my heart." The king and the minister entered a skiff and arrived at the spot amid the cries of flocks of scarlet waterbirds. Sitting on the lotus was a child of beautiful face, a delight to the eyes, a child one would consider to be 8 years old. The colour of his body was like the purple of shells, and the king marvelled, "Ema ho! Miraculous, admirable child! Who is your father? Who is your mother? What is your country? To what caste do you belong? On what do you nourish yourself? What are you doing here?" The child replied, "My father is the knowing of knowledge. My mother is Samanta Badri, holy joy and transcendent of the void. My country, I have none, having been born on the essence plane with its unique caste. I nourish myself with both clarity and perplexity. I am here devoting myself to the destruction of suffering." At these words, the king wept profusely, and his blind right eye was also opened. Trigunadhara, the orthodox minister, burst into tears as well. The prince was named Sokye Dorje, Diamond Born of the Lake. "He is the incarnation of a celestial being," thought the king. "Adored will be my blessed son." And the lotus stem was brought away with the child. They then travelled to the land of the king. Following them were birds of the water tribes, geese, grey cranes, and others. Some were following, others were uttering piercing cries, others were swooping down above the child, others were gyrating around the light points of the 4 beaches of the lake. While others, their beaks having bitten into the earth, were rolling on the ground. On the way, the travellers reached a lake shore, where fish, which had been caught by a hook and drawn to the bank, were being thrown into a net by an old, white-headed man. The fish were jumping with fear and trembling, and the guru, Tsokhi Dorje, reflected, "When I hold the king's kingdom, I will suffer like a fish caught on a hook." With such a symbol bordering upon the Dharma, he understood the causal facts. They then reached a forest, and there they saw a partridge chased by a crow. The partridge, closely pressed, reached a thorn bush, but the crow also went to the thorn bush. As a crow approached on the right, the partridge tried to escape on the left. As a crow approached on the left, the partridge tried to escape on the right. For a long time they were thus in flight and in chase, but finally the partridge escaped and was saved. Now the thorn bush resembled the king's kingdom, and the crow, Indrabhuti, while the partridge typified Tsokye Dorje, who understood this as a symbol of well-timed renunciation. And then in a place where they stopped en route, he saw the young son of an upasaka and an upasika kill a rat, which could then not return to the house. This the guru understood as a symbol of exile. If the law of the king were broken, the guru thus understood the chain of causes. Finally, the king's palace was in sight, and all joyful came to see the spectacle of their arrival. They were welcomed by 300 dancers of the tiger, of the lion, and of the Garuda. 300 rhythmic incantations were mimed and danced. 300 adorned adolescent maidens paid homage. 300 ephebs made mudras while dancing. The accomplished musicians beat large drums and other instruments, and the accomplished decorators raised the thrones and the victory banners. The greatest actors of the land put on masks and began their acts. Of the history, unabridged, of the lives of the Guru Udayana Padmasambhava, this is the 17th canto, the meeting with the King Indrabhuti sealed oaths.
Okay, so what can we make of this? The king, who has travelled to a foreign land, his eyes, one of his eyes is open, he's partially sighted spiritually, let's say. And when he goes forward to see the child, he becomes fully sighted. He gets to, both of his eyes are open. So what is it he's found? I mean, he's found Padmasambhava. Padmasambhava is 8 years old. It's quite interesting to be born at 8 years old. What does this mean? Traditionally, it's regarded that you can't become a Buddhist monk until you're 8 years old, or at least until you can control a plough, which is generally assumed to be about 8 years old. And what's the reason for this? Well, this is because in order to engage with the spiritual life, you have to have an established self-consciousness. And it's said that traditionally that it's around 8 years old that a human being gains this sense of an established self. So that from that age onwards, they can actually take responsibility and pursue a spiritual life. So that might well be why Padmasambhava is that age. He's not an infant that needs nurturing up to a point. He's at the age where he's in a way fully conscious as a human being and can start to pursue the spiritual life. He's also, when the king questions him, he's telling the king that he's a sort of enlightened being, isn't he? He's saying, my father is the knowing of knowledge. My mother is Samantabhadri, holy joy and transcendence of the void. My country I have none, having been born on the essence plane. I nourish myself with both clarity and perplexity. I am here devoting myself to the destruction of suffering. This can be read probably in many ways, but one of the ways I'm suggesting is that what has happened here is that the king, the ego, has, as it were, gained an insight into the nature of reality, which has arisen out of this purified state of consciousness, the Dharmakosha lake. So if we looked at this on a more of a kind of individual level, we could say that the unenlightened, ignorant state is initially worked on by the process of travelling to a foreign land, moving out of one's birthplace, as it were, in the spiritual sense, to go to a foreign land. And through that journey, through the effort made in that journey, the king's journey across the sea was a very difficult one, so a lot of effort had to go into that. But by doing that, he landed on the shore where he found this wish-fulfilling gem, which opened one of his eyes. So through his effort, he'd gone away from his habitual land, his native land, and he's gained a broader understanding. But that's not enough. That's not enough to do that. What he then needs is something which arises out of something which is not him. The Dharmakosha lake is something which is not really, it's not really his consciousness. It's a kind of an impersonal, not impersonal, but it's not something that can be held on to by the ego. So in experiencing this deeper state of mind, then something else arises, which is Padmasambhava. The child Padmasambhava arises and knows that his source, his parents, if you like, are the highest spiritual forces in the universe, Samantabhadra and Samantabhadri. So it's as though the Padmasambhava, the child of Padmasambhava, represents the king's insight into a transcendental realm. It represents his first vision of something which is transcendental, which is associated with enlightenment. It represents an insight into the truth, into the nature of reality. But what does the king do? He tries to take that insight into his world, into what remains of his world. And as he's doing that, as he's taking Padma, if you like, this enlightened insight into the world, then there's these three sights. There's the fish being caught. So there's the fish that used to swim freely in the lake, as it were, has now been trapped. So that this enlightened state of mind it's been caught hold of, it's been grasped in some way, in the same way that the fisherman has grasped the fish. Not only that, but then this sort of enlightened element, this insight, is chased into a thorn bush by the king. So you could say it's the ego is sort of pursuing this liberated insight into a thorn bush, which is, you know, it's tricky. It's really difficult to get out of. And so there's all this to-ing and fro-ing between the crow and the partridge in the thorn bush, between the ego and the enlightened mind, the one chasing the other, trying to possess it, but the partridge, the enlightened mind, in a way trying to escape from it. And then there's the case of the boy who's killed the rat. And in this case, Padma realizes, the enlightened mind, if you like, realizes that it needs to be killed so that it can no longer go in the house, so that it can go away from the house. It needs to die so that it can go forth from the city. This, in a way, is what happens. I won't spoil the story for you if you want to read it. But Padma is eventually thrown out of the country, for he does something which, I mean, is highly problematic, let's say. And as such, he is thrown out. So he's foreseen this in the killing of the rat. The boys kill the rat because that enlightened state is going to have to go forth from the realm of the king. It's going to have to establish its own, as it were, independent existence. Now, where I think this is relevant for us particularly is that in the course of our spiritual lives, we will get insights. We will get glimpses of this transcendental state, of this freedom, of something. Well, we'll experience it in our own way. We might experience something that's really good, or we might experience a universal love, or we might experience complete freedom, or something or other. We'll come across something which seems to us to be ultimately good, ultimately worth pursuing. Sometimes that experience can be very strong, and you can think that you've done it, you've got there, that you've actually achieved that state. But unfortunately, it's not like that, because the king, as it were, comes along and grabs you off your lotus and tries to take you back into his world. But fear not, it will happen again. Yeah? And a lot of the life and liberation of Padmasambhava is about Padma, as it were, gaining more and more, deeper and deeper degrees of enlightenment. Although he's had a pretty incredible birth. There on a lotus, it's still recognized that he isn't fully enlightened at that point. He has to go through, in fact, hundreds of years of training in order to achieve his final liberation. So I think this is one of my little hobby horses. My friends are smiling at the moment. That it's enlightenment comes in flashes. Some sort of insight comes in flashes, and it comes out of this purified state of mind, out of a higher state of consciousness. But sometimes it arises quite spontaneously, actually. But it's important to value that very, very deeply, but not grasp it, not try and hold on to it. Let it go, it'll come again. I liken it to a whole series of lightning flashes. You know, if you're in a completely dark night somewhere, and you're stumbling over stuff, you're completely lost, you don't know where you are, and there's a flash of lightning, you can suddenly see where you are.
but it goes dark again. But later on, there's another flash of lightning. It's the same kind of flash. There's nothing different about it to the first one. But you can see things even more clearer. And then there's more flashes as they come later on. Eventually, those flashes come so frequently that one can actually see what's happening. Did you see that? I like that image. Okay, so Padma has been born into the world, as it were. He's come into being. He's been taken in by the king. And it's the beginning of a whole series of adventures. We will have a break now, and then we'll come back after the tea break and join him when he's going off to meditate in the cremation grounds. So, tea break.